these things in, with respect to simplicity, are there some where it's just going to be implicit? And if that's the case, that changes the way I want to look at it. Or is a regulatory capital base always got an explicit thing? That's my first question.
I think if I can have a go at that, the regulatory capital base will have an explicit rate of return applied to it, which is typically based on the weighted average cost of capital, as we've explained before, which is why the rate doesn't reflect the characteristics of the individual items within the capital base. And you're quite right, the capital base can have all sorts of stuff.
So we're in a special world compared to our general world of these regulatory assets in this one, which was what I wanted to be clear on. So, and it's really typically the weighted average cost of capital that's applied to this base. And so then I guess, and you guys are recommending 3, and you're just going to let it show up as an implicit, partly because it's a weighted average cost of capital, and some of it's going to be explicit interest and some of it's not.
Yeah.
And is that kind of the logic?
If I can maybe just add to that, Tom, if we look back at Table 3, that 100, we're saying that 100 is a timing difference. So it will have gone through profit or loss as an expense, but the regulator is saying you can recover it over time. So that's why it's a regulatory timing difference. It's hit P&L in one period, it'll hit the rate going through revenue in later periods. If that 100, instead of being classified as an expense for IFRS purposes, was classified as PP&E for IFRS purposes, that wouldn't have gone through the P&L account. It would be in the balance sheet, in the IFRS balance sheet. The way we would account for it is exactly as it shows in Approach 3. If it was in fixed assets, mm-hmm. and the regulator said, you know, you can recover the 100 over 5 years in equal installments, but you're not going to get the return until, or you're not going to start billing the return until year 2, the Approach 3 is what we would do if it was a fixed a property, plant and equipment, which goes to Peter touched on this earlier to say these timing differences are a relatively small portion of the overall RCB. And so if we're treating the other items in the RCB, or the biggest items in the RCB, in the same way as Approach 3 here, it'd be confusing to users of financial statements to treat this differently just because we're saying it's got the cash flows themselves have got slightly different characteristics. But I think users are kind of viewing it as part of the package, and this is how the bulk of the package gets accounted for.
And so let me just ask 2 quick questions. So the regulatory capital base would normally pick up PP&E and things like that.
That's usually the biggest item.
And so you say that they, and the other thing is that because we're incremental, that we're talking about adjustments to rates, right?
Yeah.
So that there is sort of a regulatory capital base that is forming this sort of expectation. There has to be, in other words, an expectation of adjustments. We're never operating an expectation of rates. We're never operating from zero and building all the way up. So in that world, this makes it simpler as well, because in the larger context, it tidies everything up. Okay, Mike, good thing. All right.
Gary.
Thank you. Yeah, too. After Tom's second question response, my question might be redundant, but just if the example here is you're talking about a one-off transactions of 100, and the proposal is, do we segregate that for interest purposes? Or, and that's a different answer than if this is the way it's always done for all the spending. If you take off Table 3, go to Approach 3, I guess, is if they're always accumulating regulatory assets, whether they're PP&E or other things that capitalize, and you start billing the finance charges 2 years later, which is basically what this says. If that's ordinary course of business, you might be perhaps more into Approach 2. But if I'm reading this example, this is sort of an isolated incident of 100 that just, for whatever reason, it they're going to start allowing that to go into the billable situation 2 years later. And I think if that's the case, going back to your single package, I mean, I think all of a sudden having snippets and pockets inside a very large regulatory base is going to get very confusing very quickly for something that they manage. You know, the entire utility plant and service is managed on a composite basis, and you get, you know, pipes that are 100 years old and pipes that are a day old, you know, and so on. And they all look at it the same way. Yet, so I would think, again, if it's largely the one-off type example here, which I think is what we're talking about here, I think approach three is the better way to go, because I don't think we want to start dissecting the regulatory capital base of different rates on different tranches inside it that originated at different points in time. I think it starts making it very, very complex. If it's ordinary course of business, you know, approach two might be the better way to do it.
Sue?
So I'm not sure if I said which approach I actually preferred, but I prefer approach two. And just, I think that one of the main reasons why I am not comfortable with approach three is, going back to a point that I sort of alluded to but didn't talk about much first time I interjected, was we're in a situation here where we've decided there is a significant financing component, which means that if we look at the economics of what's going on, we think there's an interest element, and then we're not reflecting it in the accounting. So in the first period here, even though we know the regulator is compensating you for that financing sort of idea, we're not reflecting that. And I really find the decision to think about significant financing and then not doing that to be, for me, quite incongruous. And just to build, just in response to Gary's point about the granularity, I understand the complexity of that, but my understanding based on the discussions we've had so far is that because of the very explicit way that the adjustment mechanisms work, there is already, from an operational perspective, a lot of tracking already going on, if you like, for how all of the components of these calculations go on. So my understanding would be we'd be building on that.
My preference goes for approach two, very much for the reasons explained, in particular by Sue. But I can also see the advantages of approach three, and I'm happy to go with the majority as long as it's not approach one.
Daryl.
I just wanted to follow up on Tom's question just to make sure I'd understood the answer you gave. So the way I understood your first question was you were asking whether a regulator ever applies a blended rate that essentially says these are the future cash flows. I'm not going to give you 8 or I'm not going to give you 3. I'm going to give you 6.5. And I think that compensates. And are we saying that regulators never do that? They would always split out the RCB and they wouldn't give a blended rate. So I guess the blended rate creates a problem that I also have to think about.
I was actually asking, would they just be silent on what the rate was? They may have had that plus other, that in which I have a follow-up, but the idea that the rate was really clearly explicit,
yep.
My understanding is that's not always the case. And then when we go into these fuzzier worlds, the model has to hold up.
And I guess we're just building on that. So is it always explicit or?
Can I understand your phrase blended rate? So to me, blended rate means that you're looking at the underlying items and trying to work out what rates reflect the characteristics of them and then blend it together.
The regulator's essentially saying, let's take all the cash flows that have accumulated, some negative, some positive, and give you a rate that falls somewhere on the spectrum of 3 to 8%, because I want to compensate you to a certain extent for, and to the other extent for, market.
The way that they look at it, they do aggregate all of these positive and negative amounts, but the way that they look at the rate is to say, what is the rate that is going to protect your financial viability, to encourage you to achieve the various regulatory objectives, to make sure that you get a good enough return that investors are willing to invest in you so that you can continue to achieve these regulatory objectives. So the calculation is not based on the individual items that are going to produce the cash flows. The calculation of the rate is based on typically this weighted average cost of capital. So it's looking at the it's not necessarily the actual cost of debt in the company. It's often a deemed cost of debt plus a deemed equity element.
So, but what I'm saying is that that rate you've just described is the rate that we would describe as the, in this paper, as the RCB rate.
Yes.
Now, what I'm saying is, does the regulator take a mixture of the cash flows in one and the cash flows in two, bundle them all as a set of future cash flows that you're going to get or future cash flows you're going to, and come up with a blended rate, or do they always keep those two items completely distinct? Because I think the and this is a little bit of what I think what I'd been thinking about as Tom was asking his question, is if it's always distinct, I think that's an important assumption in saying, well, then I've got two, I can have two different approaches, one for the OPEX and one for the CAPEX, if you like. If it's, in fact, a sort of a blended return, so they negotiate back and forth and say, all right, we're prepared to allow all of these cash flows at a rate of 6.5%, it requires me to somehow think about which ones are which, if I've got two different methods. But if we are assuming it's always distinct, then that's perhaps an assumption we need to just make sure we capture if we go down a route of differential rates. Or differential approaches, not differential rates.
Well, we've been talking almost an hour about an atypical situation in an atypical industry. So can I ask everybody to, let's try to come to a conclusion quickly. Mary?
Sorry, I'm not sure I'm going to help with quickly. Because several points that came back to comments people had made. You know, Martin, I think you're concerned about splitting out different pieces and trying to stick as closely as possible to the regulatory agreement. The staff is saying that approach three is the one that keeps the accounting for these operating items that are included in the regulatory capital base consistent with the accounting for the regulatory capital for the CapEx items. But I feel like I missed kind of a decision that we were going to apply approach three to the, to the capital expenditures. So I don't think that it's automatic that you have to go with three to be consistent with those. I think, well, personally, I'd be approach two, or maybe Daryl's approach two prime. He called it four, but I'll call it two prime. And this whole discussion has been very helpful for me in thinking about the point that you raised but don't ask us to comment on now, which is this a historical cost approach, or is it a current value approach, each with modifications? Because to me, it's convinced me that it's an historical cost approach. And the reason I say that is, with historical cost, we generally aren't trying to reset to the perfect rate for each transaction. It's more that we're asking questions that if you're granted an 8% rate, do I have to adjust this because there's an impairment on the asset side? And to recognize that. And so I make the necessary adjustments, but I'm not typically resetting to the perfect rate. And so for me, going back to that sequence of, I've been promised an 8% return on this, and let me take the table two version, the more straightforward version. I've been promised an 8% return. Is it at least reasonable? Yes, it's more than reasonable. Is there anything else going on? No, there's not. Okay, then I don't have to reset the rate. I think there's an open question that we should not try to answer today, but it's going to be quite important to, I think, is what is the mirror side of this for liabilities? If the rate is too low, do I say great bonus? Or if the rate's too high, do I have to make some kind of adjustment? I just don't want us to forget about the liability side and thinking about whether there's symmetry. But to me, I think I'm very much of the approach too with the question about Daryl's two prime, which is when you move from the scenario laid out in table two to the scenario laid out in table three, do we take that basic approach of, is the rate reasonable? And if it's enough overall, do we, in that case where you have a period in which you would be recognizing zero because that's how the rate is stated, do I override the regulatory, because while it might be reasonable overall over the whole period, it's not reasonable for the amount that you'd recognize in year one when you, you know, when if you just applied the regulatory rate. And I think the question we then have to work through is the benefit of that, you know, of that additional adjustment to go to the EIR and sufficient information to tweak it from 2 to 2 prime. So I don't support approach 3 because while it brings in the basic recognition of the 100 of regulatory asset, it doesn't, you know, the rest of it, the whole recognition of the finance cost is basically where we are today, which we have said is the problem we need to fix. So I don't agree with 3, and I don't think it delivers symmetry with anything else, because I don't think I'd apply 3 for the capital expenditures either.
Okay, so now we've filled the hour. Jen Chow?
Okay, very quick, okay. Yeah, I agree with approach 3, sorry. But the reason is that why I think the regulator obviously gave compensation to the entity, but not necessarily the entity has earned compensation. When they earn compensation, only when the entity provide a service to the customer and can build money to the customer. At that point, then they can recognize those return. So this is why I agree with approach 3. As Sue mentioned, that based on approach 3, exactly there are some very valuable information missing based on the performance statement. So that's, I suggest that additional disclosure should be required, such as what's the overall return, what's the component of the return, and what's the impact of the future, you know, performance statements, and this kind of information can disclose to and then can, I think, will be useful for the users to forecast the future cash flow.
Tom?
So I got to go back and just make sure. So we have, let's go to this $100 expenditure. In this case, it's going to go flowing through the regulatory capital. We have other cases where it might not, but they could give us a rate break down the road. Okay, so if we're doing a little decision tree, we have $100, the regulator is going to include it, but it's going to include it in a very specific way in this example. Just on what Mary said about liability, would there ever be a liability case where we would be getting the rate deal up front, but it's somehow going to flow through the capital base? Or is liability just off the table in this example?
No, you can have negative adjustments to the regulatory capital base as well as positive ones.
So if they gave you money up front for capital stuff, okay, just so it's symmetric, all right.
It's symmetric.
But what I wanted to come back to is, which I didn't fully realize, I don't think, is these are very different worlds, and I think it also goes a little bit to very careful. We're in an asset liability world, and we are not in, so what's not happening? Okay, we're spending 100, it's being expensed, normal GAAP. We are not capitalizing it, we're not deferring it. What's happening is the regulator is going to give us an enhanced rate down the road, but it's going to do it in a very specific way. It's going to shove it into the capital base, it's going to apply its 8%, and it's going to spew out a number. Had the $100 or 100 pounds or 100 currency units been not a capital base one, then the regulator could have gone and said, okay, we're going to give you a break on this, we're going to give you the same, exactly the same set. And they might have been less clear about interest rates, in which case we would have been into that implicit world. I just want to come back to the asset liability thing for a moment then. Let's do the set aside the capital expenditure, because this will be critical, because one of the things we'll be attacked on is you're creating deferred assets or you're matching or something of that nature. So it's really important that we stay in the asset liability world. In the first case where you're just expensing it and the regulator is giving the deal and it's not flowing through this capital thing, fundamentally, if they just said you're getting 28 next period and they're relatively silent about how they got there, may have been qualitative, then you would, in establishing and measuring the asset, you would say we're getting a break of 28 next period. You could then say, okay, what's the value of that? In other words, the asset derives from being able to charge a higher rate next period, and you could say, what's that in today's dollars? Should we be discounting at all? And then we go through all those things. In which case, we might look at the 3%. It's easier to think about the 3% because the capital base comes with a really specific rate. But this one doesn't. And if in this world, notice we're not, it's not the 100. It's the 28 and the 26. In other words, you might have got it as a bonus. There's no 100. You've been a great company. We're giving you a bonus, 28, 26. You've still got a problem of an asset that you're being paid in the future, and you're going to have to set a value today. And I just, when we go through, and it may have, maybe when we get back, because I didn't understand these two classes, but I think it's really clear, important that we be clear about that. So I'll ask a question. Am I right that fundamentally the asset comes from the incremental rate that we get, and it's those future flows, and we have to set a value to that asset today, and the 100 is just a trigger or an input to that setting of the rate. But the fundamental thing is, another, they could tell us nothing, and we would still have those flows, and we still have to set a rate today, and there would be no gain or loss per se if they told us nothing.
Yeah.
We would still set, the asset is either 100 or 100 and whatever. And so I'm back to that very, are you going to kind of help us with that distinction as we go down?
The answer is yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, Gary?
I'll be quick. Having listened to all this, I still stand with, I think approach three is the better of the answers. I think, although yes, you know, the individual 100 here probably is tracked in the system, but it's tracked in the system mostly for the purpose of when do I start billing it? They start when I get to billing at 28. That's the whole regulatory thing, is the billings to rate-paying customers. I think once it's in a regulatory base, I think it's just part of a massive corpus. So this example looks sort of extreme, but it's one transaction inside a much bigger universe. So, okay, we're in year X1, I'm making a 0% return on this particular spending. It's supposed to be getting 8%. Well, what if it brought the whole regulatory base return down to 7.8%? I mean, who's going to say the end result in total is unreasonable? I mean, 7.8% is still way over your 3% funding rate and so on. So I think the purpose of this project is to track, account for the regulatory agreement. I think the clearer we can state that, the better. I think Approach 3 does that.
Okay, can I see who supports Approach 3?
We were going to vote
out.
Seven.
Seven?
No, I'll throw in.
Huh?
Which one?
With Tom.
And me.
Eight.
Eight?
Eight.
Okay.
Book three, right?
Book three. All right, proceed.
So, if we go now then to the first section, which is covered in paragraphs 26 to 36. This paragraph deals with regulatory timing differences that relate to items forming part of the regulatory OPEX. And I'm going to be very brief in here. So our recommendation in this section is to use a discount rate to discount the cash flows arising from this type of regulatory timing differences that reflect the characteristics of those cash flows, meaning provides a compensation for time value of money and uncertainty inherent in the cash flows. This is aligned to question one. And then we have a second recommendation in this section, which is in paragraph 35. And that recommendation deals when the regulatory interest rate or return provides an additional return, but the entity doesn't have clear evidence that the excess relates to an identifiable transactional event. And in that case, then the entity would use the regulatory interest or return rate to discount the estimated cash flows arising from both the recovery of the regulatory timing difference and the regulatory interest or return. And that would be equivalent to approach two in paragraph 44 of the regulatory capital base. We did not suggest using the same simplified approach as approach three for this item, so we can see that could be a valid approach here too.
And that would be aligned with question two.
Daryl.
So just a couple of questions. I just need to find the paragraph. In paragraph 30, I think we talk about the circumstance in which the rate that you determine from a market perspective may be different for a liability than it is for an asset. And given the way that we've thought about the whole process through as we think about the individual assets and the individual liabilities, in a perfect world, you would have a different reasonable rate for the asset and the liabilities. But I think most of these transactions actually require or you expect to have offsetting cash flows. And I think it might just be useful to have something in the basis of conclusions or something along those lines, because I think you get an odd outcome if you argue that the rate is too little in one circumstance and appropriate in the other circumstance, even though it's the same rate, and you expect the cash flows to offset. I wanted to test the thought process. Well, let me just ask them, 33 and 34, the two sort of crunch paragraphs in this, because they're telling us how to treat a rate shortfall and how to treat a rate excess. I struggled a little bit in my own mind, and it comes back to the question I just asked on the own credit issue, in how I deal with these two circumstances if instead of assets, these are liabilities. So a rate that is too high for an asset, we say, is good, but presumably we would say the same rate that is too high for a liability is possibly bad. Mm-hmm. And again, I think if we're thinking about offsetting cash flows, we may just need to play through how that actually comes through in practice. And then, and this is where I said the changing of the order might have caught me out a little bit. Am I correct in thinking about 34 that if I had to achieve, given the example we've just discussed in the other part of the conversation, if under 34 the rate that the regulator gave me was 8%, so the same 8% that we said we wouldn't consider in the previous one, under this approach here we would take the 8% as and spread it over the life of. So we would treat the same 8% very differently depending on the label that the regulator has put on it. Okay.
Mary?
I'm trying to check the clarity of a couple things. One is Daryl raised the liability issue, which I had flagged before. We haven't discussed and we don't have anything in here on liabilities, right? I think we have to think through that separately to see if we come up with symmetry or asymmetry to the point that's raised in question two. I'm just checking that you don't think we're resolving this for liabilities as well as for assets.
I think in terms of the OPEX type thing, I'm doubting myself now. I thought we were. Certainly for the RCB one, I thought we were being symmetric for the two because it was just the global rate for a number. And you wouldn't say individual cash flows then could be onerous because we're looking at the package. When we're looking at these individual timing differences, my thought process was that perhaps we were in the same play, again, with Daryl's comment that we're expecting offsets. So rather than looking at individual timing differences to say this rate is onerous, to use a mm-hmm. want of a better phrase, I think that would be quite difficult because the regulator is looking at it as this package of...
Except we haven't brought together how that relates to the fact that our conclusion at the beginning is that the unit of account is the individual adjustment.
Yeah.
And I think we have two work streams that don't line up. So I think we have to think about that because, I think one question is whether this is all about determining the reasonableness of the rate or, and then going ahead and accounting at the unit level, or whether we are kind of backtracking on the unit of account as the individual adjustment and then considering the rate when it applies to the net of something. And since we've been very clear that we've rejected the net change in regulatory asset or liability, I think we have to think about that. So I think we should take the vote today on just looking at the asset side and then come back and think about the liability. So I think we could get ourselves in a bigger tangle. And then with respect to question one, as it's drafted, it implies that you would throw out whatever the stated regulatory rate is in every circumstance and adjust the rate to be the one that is reasonable for the risk. So going back to the example we were looking at in Section 2, the wording of Question 1 suggests to me that you must measure at 3% in every case, not 8%, because it doesn't go through the whole stop and consider if the rate is reasonable. If it is reasonable, apply the regulatory rate. If it's not reasonable, then adjust the discount to be a rate that is consistent, for this. It just says do that in every case. Does the staff mean for Question 1 to actually be this is how you assess the reasonableness of the rate? Or does it mean what it says, which is you shall reset the rate for every measurement?
Well, that was my question, because I wanted to raise the question that in the summary recommendations we have a but. Between, which suggested to me that you would do one unless you had two. Mm-hmm. But in the questions, the but has been left out. And so for me, it was very important to have the but.
Yeah, very important.
You really need a but?
Question two is picking up. So I think question one is the reasonableness, but question two, then, unless you've got a specific reason for it, then it kicks in. Yeah. So I think maybe it is a but.
So two prevails?
Yes, two prevails.
So question one is how you assess the reasonableness.
Well, I think we've dropped the reasonableness wording because we thought it wasn't going to be helpful. Yeah. So question one is setting out the principle, but question two has a kind of override to that if you can't see a clear reason why it's different, then you go with the regulatory.
Don't you need the reasonable rate in question one to apply paragraph 33? Because if it is lower than the reasonable rate, then we recognize a loss.
Yes.
So I think you need the reasonable rate in question one in order to apply 33.
Yeah.
And then once you've moved beyond that, 34 automatically applies question two.
Yeah. Mm. There's a but and an and.
Okay, I think maybe it should be at least compensates, and if not, that's when you've got a lower value for your asset. But if it provides at least or more, then we're into two.
With these clarifications, can we agree with question one and two?
With the view that the unit of account comes back as a thing to think about?
Yes.
Because for the liability.
Does the staff nod?
Yeah.
Okay. This was one and two.
The third type of regulatory timing differences that the paper covers are in paragraphs 37 to 52. And some regulatory timing differences arises when an entity recognizes an expense or income in the current period, but the regulatory agreement will not include that item in allowed expenditures until a future period when the entity pays or receives the related cash. And we have analogized these regulatory items to indemnifications in IFRS 3 or reimbursements in IAS 37. We recommend that the regulatory item is recognized and measured on the same basis as the underlying items, which is consistent with the requirements in IFRS 3 for an indemnification asset. And this would extend to the discount rate used when measuring the regulatory asset or regulatory liability that relates to that underlying. Applying the same principle as in IFRS 3, we recommend then that if the regulatory asset or regulatory liability is subject to risks that are not present in the underlying item, and risks such as credit risk, demand, or regulatory risk, then the measurement of the related regulatory asset or regulatory liability should be adjusted to reflect those risks as described in paragraph 60 of the paper. And we have two questions, which are after paragraph 71. Question 4 and question 5.
Sue?
A couple of questions. So, if I look at paragraph 67, if we had a situation where they were being compensated for the expenditure of $1,000, but they actually say pay it in some sort of extended period between, say, X20 and X25 and paid more than the $1,000 to compensate for time value of money, what would happen then? So we'd have accrual, if we mirror the liability accounting, we'd be recognising interest, if I understand correctly, in the period up until X20.
Yeah.
But then if the regulator pays us on a deferred basis over an extended period post that and actually compensates for time value of money, what would we be doing?
As far as the example assumes that the compensation that we will get over the period when this item is included in the regulatory expenditures is an appropriate compensation for time value of money and cost. So, and because that interest that we are getting is built in the same period, then from the point of view of the measurement of the asset, then you would have no effect, and what you would get is an additional revenue in those periods. So there would not be an impact on the accounting of the regulatory assets through years X0 to X20, just because.
But what about the subsequent period? That's what I'm focused on. So if from 20 on they actually paid you back more than $1,000, so they pay you back.
Which is 8%. The case in here as well. So they are going to pay us.
Return.
Well, if it's beyond the compensation for time value of money and uncertainty inherent in the cash flows, what we would be saying is that that extra return should be recognized over the outstanding life of the regulatory time indifference.
So what, you go back to your second, the previous question, so it's a combination of mirroring plus the other decision?
So at the time that expenditure is spent, so the cash is spent, that's the time the regulator then makes the decision whether to treat it as part of the RCB or whether to treat it as part of the OPEX, and it would drop into...
Can I ask Sue's question slightly differently? So in the decision we've just taken, we said under 33, if the rate that you pay is inadequate, you would recognise a day one loss.
Yes.
Now, assume in this example, what I would do is I would recognise the same rate as the underlying up until the 20th year, and then if paragraph 33 was triggered, I'd recognize a loss in the 20th year.
Yes.
And then, or would I say that qualifies under your question five, that the risks are different?
Yeah.
I'd say the risks are different. So I would recognize the loss over the period slowly because I'm taking account of the differences in the risks.
Yes. I guess it would depend on the moment you realize that you would not get compensated enough.
So if I know up front from the beginning, I wouldn't have to wait until the 20th year to make a loss. I would treat that as a different risk. I think that might be important to make that clear somewhere, because I think that's...
This is one of the reasons why one of the first things I said was I'm worried about how complex all of these interactions are, because I think it's going to be quite complicated to explain which model you're in for different purposes because of all the slicing and dicing we're doing, which is why I didn't support the last one either, because I don't like the slicing and dicing.
So am I right in thinking you're approach two, Sue? And approach two is effectively the OPEX as well.
Be consistent.
Mary?
I struggled with the proposal for referring to the underlying as the basis for determining the interest rate, because one of the lessons I took from last month's discussion is the underlying isn't relevant for the accounting we're doing for the rights and obligations. We're accounting for the rights and obligations we've earned. We aren't trying to do some kind of mirroring. So I question why we would do we would set the rate at which we, at which we recognize regulatory income, based on the rate that we've determined is the unwind for the liability for the cleanup costs. I think the one that I see as potentially different, and I would carve out, and I don't know what the answer is the income taxes. Because I think the deferred tax comes into the situation that you quoted in the paper about an accounting mismatch, because it's IFRS standards that say don't discount deferred taxes, and yet we are recognizing the regulatory asset or liability relating to taxes, requiring it to be done on a discounted basis. So I'd want to think about whether the ignore the underlying triumphs or the we've created it because of our deferred tax model. But with deferred taxes aside, the fact that pensions or cleanup or decommissioning may be on a cash basis for regulatory purposes, I don't think matters. It's, you know, we've earned a regulatory right if we have recognized, you know, if we've, I think the question is whether recognizing the expense in the current period for cleanup when you haven't actually done the cleanup activity means you should recognize a regulatory asset today, or whether you wait until you actually perform the activity, not just accrue the cost. And so I think we should be reanalyzing those other items on, you know, on that point of, is it conducting the activity or is it recognizing the expense that's the accounting trigger? And, but I don't support the staff proposal that summarized in question four, because I think the underlying is not determinative for the regulatory asset and liability that we're accounting for.
Okay. Yeah.
Sorry, if I could, I appreciate the sort of how we articulate this is really difficult, but that we are trying to account for the right here and what the right, if we perhaps look at the example we've got and simplify it slightly to say, instead of taking 2 years then to recover the actual expenditure through the rate, the regulator says that you can recover in the same period you spend.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the two things happen at the same time, and we can predict when that's going to happen. So we know it's going to be in X20. So in that case, our right is that we will be able to recover what we spend in X20.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're trying to get at here is then, well, how do you measure that right? And at the moment, we have a standard that says, well, you measure what you're going to spend in this way. So in this case, we're in IAS 37 that tells right. you how to spend it. So our right is to recover what we spend. And if we've already got a measure for what we spend, as we said, this is kind of the reimbursement. The right is the reimbursement of what we spend. So it seems natural the two amounts should be the same because you're recovering, your right is to recover what it is that you spend. And you're right, deferred tax, we have a difficulty in that the requirement of IS 12 is don't measure it based on a discounted cash flow basis for lots of reasons. But it would seem, as trying to put myself in the position of a user of the financial statements, it would seem really weird to me to say, I have a right to recover this amount, but I'm going to measure the amount that I'm going to spend at this under this basis, and I'm going to measure the right to recover it under a completely different basis. So I get two completely different numbers, even though I know the economics is it's going to be the same at the end of the day.
But just to go back to Mary's point about what the trigger was, in this example, what happened was you messed up the environment and you're going to have to clean it up. So that was the thing you did in this period.
In the example of cleanup costs,
using that as an example. Now, the regulator is going to pay you in 20 years when you actually settle the bill for the damage you did in this period. And what the regulator's doing, going back to Tom's original point, it's not separated into interest and a present value component. It's just a single future value component. And so what we're talking about here is how to allocate between an interest component and a service component, if you like. And that's what setting the discount rate is going to do in this case. Now, if we take the specific example here, you're in IAS 37. IAS 37 says, theoretically at least, it's the risks specific to the liability. So you've made some judgment for IAS 37. The liability and the indemnification asset, if I can put it that way, are subject to the same risks. And so it seems sensible, really, to use the same approach on both sides. I agree it gets a bit more difficult when the measurement of the underlying item is less explicit about the risks, for example. But that's why we included the tax example as a more difficult case.
Daryl?
So I'm getting worried today that you and I would agree on everything. So I'm glad this topic came up. So I was actually relatively comfortable with the cleanup cost example, because I think my understanding there is that the measurement of the underlying, as you say, there is a trigger event. You've done something that gives rise to the liability. That also gives the right. That also gives rise to the right to recover against that liability. So I was comfortable with that. I was comfortable with a similar rate, because what we're saying is that the two cash flows have similar risks. And importantly, the underlying measurement of the liability takes account of its risks. So I was comfortable we were getting an asset that I was comfortable with saying essentially that it was a appropriate simplification to say you can use the rate of the liability because it's taking account of the same things you should be taking account of the asset. The one I really struggled with is the one you've mentioned, deferred tax. So what it seems like there is we're going beyond what I consider to be the objective of this project. We're not just correcting for the impact of the rate regulated agreement. We're going a step beyond that and correcting for something that is otherwise possibly a problem for other suppliers of IFRS. And so in my mind, this is a little bit similar to the OCI discussion last month, is that we're going a step too far in trying to deal with that. So I would be very comfortable with the cleanup costs and any circumstance where the liability is appropriately pricing for the risks that are in it, but not where the liability is not. I think the asset should appropriately be the right that we're going to get should be appropriately priced.
Françoise?
I would like to support Dower's position. I share it completely.
Okay. Can I see who agrees with question four?
That's not Dower's position.
I mean, subject to...
Subject to the deferred tax or as written?
I think you probably agree with four. It's five. It's what you adjust that rate for. So if the underlying rate does not reflect the risks, then you must adjust it for that. So I think you could probably argue that we agree with four, but then I disagree with five. I think it should be adjusting for more.
Yeah, so with that addition, can we support?
Have staff understood exactly what Dara say? Because we can vote and then...
Could we maybe vote on four first and then five, and then I think a supplementary question on whether there are circumstances when we should do something else. I'm actually
what
struggling
that means
to...
for deferred tax, perhaps.
I think the way Daryl worded it, it might be an example of something broader, but I'm not sure I could word a precise question
on
the run.
That's the problem.
We just delay the vote.
Question four as asked.
And I think it would be helpful to us if we can vote on four and five as written, and then a follow-up question of whether you think there are circumstances where we should consider doing something else. And I think we'd have to come back on precisely what that is, probably.
So you come back on all deferred tax assets? Deferred tax.
I don't think the way Daryl expressed it was specifically about deferred tax. I think that was
an example. But so what you're saying is you're going to ask us four and five. If we have a majority for four and five as written, we go away.
Yeah.
If we do not have a majority for four and five as written, you'd have to bring us something back.
I'd rather vote on four and five as written and then have a supplementary question that says, are there circumstances where we should do something else?
Okay.
And then if there's a majority for that, we'd have to come back on what that something else is. And
four and five as written.
With the next question coming. Yes.
Four and five as written.
I'm not sure what I'm for voting.
I think you're in the no camp because you want staff to come back to expand on what's in for.
Yeah, I want to understand better what I vote for.
So that means we'd need some guidance on what you think we need to do to bring it back, which I guess is to explore Daryl's suggestion. Is that what you'd like us to do?
And what impact that has on questions four and five?
So yes, I'll vote for my suggestion.
Does that mean we're not voting on four and five? We're just going to bring
it back.
I think we did just vote
on
four and five and six.
Okay. That brings us to the end of this discussion. I think for the next time it might be advisable that board advisors and staff communicate a little bit more often. And let's take a 5-minute break.